In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about personality and how it develops as we get older. Now, it's generally believed, I think most people believe, that once we become an adult, our personalities don't change very much. And in fact, there are a lot of psychologists that would argue the same thing. They would say that basically this set of characteristics that makes us who we are is in large part genetically determined. And it's something that develops early on as we're children. And by the time that we get to about 30, it's done. It's set. That's it. We're not going to change. However, there are other researchers, and there's been some research published on this just recently, that suggest that that's not the case, that personality is not set in stone in that way, and that it is possible for people to change as they get older. We have here in the studio with us two psychologists who are interested in this very subject, and we'll be talking about it, about personality development in adulthood. Our two guests are Brent Roberts and Ashley Beidle. Brent Roberts is professor of psychology at the U of I here in Urbana-Champaign, and this whole business of personality is something that is a particular interest of his. Also with us, Ashley Beidle, he's a clinical psychologist who has a practice here in Champaign, Urbana, again, that's also something that he's interested in as well. So we can try and talk about it from a couple of perspectives, from the perspective of someone who is a researcher, but also from the perspective of someone who works in a counseling kind of mode. I'm interested in all of these things. And as questions come in, if people are listening have questions, you can certainly give us a call. And I know our guests would do their best to give you an answer, tell you what they think. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you both very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
If I use the term personality, I guess I think I know what that means. And that's a kind of a word that we use in a loose sort of a sense. Often, I guess, as a way of talking about how we perceive other people and basically whether we like them or whether we don't, whether we want to spend time with them or not. When psychologists use the term personality, what do you mean?
Well, we mean the same thing in large part, but we do get, of course, a little more particular about the definition. The studies that you're referring to focus more on what we think of as personality traits, which are the tendencies for us to be relatively consistent in the patterns of thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that we exhibit over time. And that's one aspect of personality. It's not the complete aspect from at least my perspective. There are also the motives that we have for doing things. There are the abilities that we demonstrate in everyday living. And there are also the stories we tell about ourselves. And these are in many respects much more compelling for people in everyday life than the traits or the motives or even the abilities we have, be it the stories we tell about ourselves or how we describe ourselves to other people and to ourselves in some respects. So personality as a field is a much broader thing than just personality traits per se.
Mm-hmm. What interests you about personality?
I can answer that. In my case, it's somewhat enthralling to try to understand why each of us is different in our own unique way to begin with, and then part of those, and it's a wonderfully complex and interesting and dynamic story. So part of it is genetic, part of it is your environment when you grow up, and we're only now discovering some of the reasons for how we develop the way we do and why we have these differences. And then for me in particular, my interest developed around personality development and how and why we continue to change. So what are the patterns that people demonstrate as they grow older, and do we continue to change at ages that people suspect we should not? And then what are the reasons for why we do that? And that's been mostly my concern for the last two decades or so.
I guess if it's sort of my perception that that people do believe that personality gets set very early, and that we have this notion that people don't change. The changing is is not easy if it happens at all. What purpose is served by believing that? Believing that, you know, you think people can change, you think you can make people change, but you can't. As far as we're concerned, if we're talking about ourselves or if we're talking about other people, What purpose does it serve to have that rigid idea about the fact that personality doesn't change? Or does it serve some kind of purpose?
Interesting question. I think at the first level, it's relatively nice to have a predictable world. If each of us came into our social relationships day by day acting completely different, it would be a relatively chaotic and confusing place. So I think having a predictable world is a nice thing. Beyond that, I think the lay perspective on personality is largely correct in the sense that people are not transforming their personality day to day, year to year, or even decade to decade. People are not becoming different people as they age. So there's, an acute sensitivity on the part of individuals looking at themselves and looking at other people that personality is a relatively stable thing. And I think the scientific data supports them in that. What becomes an issue is, you know, where we are on the margins. Do we continue to change in some respects? How much do we change? And then in related to that, we can get to it. The changes that we see in the scientific studies we do aren't tremendously dramatic year to year. And given the fact that we don't see huge changes in personality traits year to year, then the perspective that people stay relatively the same is probably correct. And the perspective that the attempt to change somebody in a few weeks is going to fail is probably correct also. But the stronger assumption that your personality does not change at all isn't supported by the scientific research that we see.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a tendency in all of us to want to have the simplest explanation, reduce it down to its simplest form. And it's also kind of a relief or unburdening to say, well, that's the reason, rather than kind of being kind of messy and a messy internal process.
Well, if we come down to say that while dramatic changes in personality over the course of life are maybe not likely, and small but significant changes do occur, then I guess one of the things I'm curious about is for people who do therapy, is the amount of change that's possible significant enough so that this actually gives you some encouragement that it is possible, particularly if there are aspects of people's personality that are problematic, that are making it difficult for them to live their lives and get along with other people, that you can say either to yourself or to them, it actually is possible for this to change, provided, of course, that they want, the old joke, provided, of course, that they want to change. I mean, does this have implications for people who work in a one-on-one in a counseling kind of relationship?
Yeah, if we didn't believe that some kind of change was possible, we wouldn't be doing
what,
the
what would be the point?
Yeah. People wouldn't be coming to us. Yeah. Well, you know, I kind of have to decide what it is you're looking at, what's to change. You know, are people having trouble kind of in their everyday lives and holding down a job or making a relationship work, or you know, so in some sense, you know, it's better to look at the behavior and what's not working right, and can things change? Yeah, they can change. Does that mean that somebody's made a fundamental change in their personality? Well, maybe not necessarily, but they can be much more adaptive, much more flexible, much more functional. Within their style, within, you know, if they're a very sensitive person or a very ambitious person or a shy person, you know, but they may have trouble because of their kind of disposition or their temperament, but they can learn to handle things differently.
So it is, for example, if you do have somebody, say, is somebody who is extremely shy, who finds that difficult. They find it difficult in work. They find it difficult in social situations, and they feel that somehow that's holding them back from having good relationship with other people and being successful in their career or whatever it is. So we just pick that as one thing that you would say. Well, you know, it actually is possible to have some change in that. If you, my client, if that's the issue and that's what you want to work on, then I can say, well, yeah, actually, I think that it is possible to change that. We're not going to make you the most outgoing person in the world, but we can make it so that you'll be happier, you'll be more successful. We can make some progress on those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, some of what we call personality emerges from differences in temperament. And then if somebody is especially sensitive and shy, they can be avoidant, and they can kind of start to live their lives that way. Yeah. But part of the change that would they probably want to occur that maybe doesn't occur is that, you know, you need to learn to tolerate the feelings that emerge. And in those people, that's a lot more intense.
Yeah.
So the process of change is learning to maybe tolerate those feelings in increments that they can handle. And a lot of people, especially in people who are intelligent, can kind of use their intelligence and their awareness to help them move along. They can also kind of identify something that's of enough significant importance to them that they're willing to go through the feelings that that it takes to get there. And yeah. And in the process of doing all that, things change. People become more comfortable.
I should introduce again our two guests here. Ashley Beidle is a licensed clinical psychologist with a private practice in Champaign. And Brent Roberts is professor of psychology at University of Illinois. And we're talking about personality, but what it is. We'll try and talk a little bit about how it is that psychologists try to measure it and put some names on different aspects of personality. And then with this notion of what forms personality, how much of it is a result of life experience, and how much of it maybe we're born with, and to what extent personality continues to change as we get older. So as I said at the beginning, there are a lot of people who would argue that it doesn't really, once you get into adulthood, once you get to, 20, 30, there isn't any more change. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think we have a caller here to talk with on our line number one. Hello.
Hello. Well, I guess I'm interested in the phases that people may go through in life, whether they have to do with developmental phases or whether for some reason, either hereditarily or due to some life event, they're thrown into a depression or into some bipolar state. For example, people say that the longer one waits to get, quote, treatment, which I guess now means drugs, for depression, then the longer that depression is likely to last or the more difficult it would become to treat, as if, certain life experiences mark the brain or something to that effect. So I guess, and also, then, we have this sense, we like to think of ourselves, we tell ourselves stories, that we have some solid self, or members of our family have an idea of who we are, or our friends. But then, we can either become very attached to that notion of self and not want to change, or else we can have a desire to change and try to control it. So I guess I'm just wondering if you can talk about some of these newer drugs and the effects that they have, and whether they can either have long-term effects even after one stops using them, perhaps negatively, or whether, we go through phases in life and we may have to face hardship or melancholy, and whether, people still believe that sometimes going through such processes naturally can have positive effects, or that it's better to intervene with some kind of medication, for example.
Well, those are big and complicated and interesting questions. I don't know how well we can do with them, but you want to take a shot?
Well, we have a few dissertations here to write.
I know.
I'm supposed to push my cough button. Well, you're asking about drugs and depression and vulnerability to relapse, and all of that's kind of still being researched. And I just read an article the other day about chances of relapse after recovery from depression, and they were comparing medication and psychotherapy, and it was showing that the psychotherapy led to less risk of relapse, and they were kind of speculating on why that might be. And it seemed like psychotherapy and the drugs had different effects on the person and the brain and in different ways. But kind of what we've always psychologists have kind of have concluded from the research is that when there's a severe depression, usually both are necessary. Some people are so severely depressed that they just cannot even do the work of getting up and taking care of themselves, getting out of bed, maintaining themselves or their families without the medication. So the medication puts a
a floor under them so that they can do the work. But that not necessarily may not be what would be the long-term year after year solution. There are some people who suffer from illness that do need to stay on medication. Psychotherapy probably affects something different. It's more the cortex, the thinking, how a person views themselves and in their world, and that I think buffers them from vulnerability to depression, especially when it's a depression that comes from life events and relationships, rather than a depression that comes from the inside, which is maybe more chemical and biologically based. So we're still trying to find out about things like neuroplasticity of the brain and what kind of changes occur from experience. Certainly, trauma affects us. If I test a kid who's been sexually abused as a kid, they may look retarded on some verbal scales because they maybe just don't want to think too deeply about things, but they're very high on other scales that have to do with vigilance. They can spot what's wrong in their environment instantly, and so that it kind of tells you that the brain develops, and we become adaptive because of our experience. So there's quite an interaction.
Speaking as a not a clinical psychologist, there is some provocative studies showing that if you go to a clinician, the result is in part personality change. So it hasn't been the focus of many clinical outcome studies, but some of the studies have included personality trait measures. And in those studies, if you go see a clinician, you get, let's say, better on something like neuroticism. You decrease your neuroticism, you increase on your more personality-based depression. So my first comment would be that if you're delaying to see a therapist, there's no reason to delay, go see them. It could probably help you tremendously. The second thing I would say is that we know that there are life events that people have that both cause good things and bad things. So the most provocative findings have been, and this is related to depression, investment in your social world. So becoming committed to a relationship, a loving relationship, attaching yourself significantly to a work relationship, having a career and having an identity surrounding that, seems to be a very strong influence over personality trait development, especially in young adulthood. And so people who do these things tend to get less neurotic. They tend to become more warm and compassionate and more responsible. And so we do see that some of the events and paths that people follow do result in some of the changes that we're interested in. The interesting thing is that if somebody does, let's say, coalesce around something like depression and it becomes something central to their identity and their personality, the problems that result are pretty profound in the sense that they might not do some of the things that they could do to get themselves out of it. And that's where I think a therapist can be quite helpful.
Well, it's interesting that we have for so long in so many different cultures or religious kinds of approaches talked about suffering and somehow that working through suffering is going to create a transformation. And I'm not necessarily convinced that that's true, but that certainly seems not to be, the approach of, American psychiatric drugs. And I'm not fighting against them it's just interesting that this notion of suffering is good, maybe since we didn't have anything to do, a way of controlling suffering, we told people that it was good for them.
Well, there's, it's kind of depends upon the person and the situation. So, therapy, for instance, there's a need maybe to go back and look at past stuff to do the suffering part that you're talking about, because people who are stuck and keep repeating the same stuckness over and over probably are stuck for a reason. So sometimes you need to go back and get at what's causing the person to be stuck. Now, for other people, it's better to be working more on the front end of things, getting on with their lives, getting out there, and in the process of doing that, they become better at doing it. So if the person's anxious, but they're they're out there engaging, they become less anxious in more and more situations. Now, when you enter drugs into the whole thing, which has totally revolutionized our thinking in the last 20 years, you can get what seems like personality change from medication, especially these Prozac and all the cousins, the serotonin reuptake drugs. And what I find is that people who, for instance, are hypersensitive or very anxious or shy or really have struggled can sometimes feel more in control, kind of have less background noise in their lives, and can engage more effectively, and in the process of that become more competent in their lives, and then often don't need the medication anymore. Or it makes them just feel like they're in more control of their lives, and they're better able to engage.
Yeah, I don't know if David wants to take any more questions from me, but about antidepressants for something like bipolar, I've heard that that actually you could give a wrong medication for a certain kind of illness, and that actually would have a negative effect on that illness, that would somehow affect the brain in a negative way, inadvertently misdiagnosing something like that. So that these, I'm just wondering whether these kinds of medications or even life experiences can mark the brain in ways that maybe they're not irreversible, but they cause us to go in another direction, for example.
Well, bipolar disorder, true bipolar disorder is a biochemical disorder, and it needs to be evaluated and treated by a psychiatrist. It's often an illness that's overdiagnosed because the symptoms of mania or severe depression can be the result of many other causes, but if that's the disorder, it needs to be accurately diagnosed, because the wrong medication, many of the medications that are used for other forms of depression would exacerbate the problem, especially the mania. So, but that's, Brent and I are not psychiatrists, so we're a little far out of our field here.
Well, just to sort of round this out, now I think one of the things that is helping us understand the brain more and more and the way it functions is the ability, by using various kinds of technologies, to actually watch the brain at work. You know, we can take a person and we can put them through various kinds of experiences and tests and ask them to do things. And while they're doing that, we can actually watch the brain and watch what parts of it are working, how they're communicating with one another. So we're getting a better understanding of exactly how it works. And I think that kind of research, does it not indeed show that experiences can, in fact, change the brain?
Yeah, I think we tend to reify the brain and genes as things that are ultimate causes of whatever we do. And I think especially Bill Greenow's research and Art Kramer over at the Beckman has a series of wonderful studies with Stan Kolkham looking at the simple act of exercising. And it shows profound effects on the brain. The function and structure of the brain in older individuals changes over a six-month period just by getting off the couch and actually doing some walking. And that, in turn, affects things like cognitive ability measures and your ability to process and use information. So I think the perspective that something is in the brain is causal is maybe a little too strong of an inference. And it's really clear from studies that are coming out now that when you do something in life, it has to go through the brain. If you change psychologically, behaviorally, or in any other way, your brain is changing too. Mm-hmm. So it's almost, it becomes a non-issue in some respects. I mean, it's interesting to find what part of the brain is relevant to what we do and in what ways it can and does change. But it does change, and that's a very important fact that I think is sometimes missed.
Yeah. Well, as we have learned more and more about the human genetic makeup, maybe no surprise, we've started to become really interested in the idea that all kinds of things can be attributed to genetics. And it wasn't very long after we had started doing the mapping that, for example, someone came out and said, well, I've got this gene here, and I think maybe this gene has something to do with risk-taking. So here now we're starting to talk about one's willingness to take risk being something genetic. And I'm sure that there are other sorts of aspects like that, that people are maybe saying, well, maybe, you know, certain sorts of characteristics are genetically determined. And I'm sure now parents, anybody who's had children will say, this is no news to me. You know, I had two children, I had three children, and from the time they were born, I knew these children were different. And they had they came with distinct personalities. They were wired. It couldn't be anything other than genetic. So, you know, all of that loads up on this side where we'd say, oh, well, personality, yeah, it is genetically determined. Of course, we can see that from the beginning. And at the same time, I'm sure people would say, well, now, wait a minute, that's not the whole deal. So, you know, how exactly in talking about personality and the characteristics that make us who we are, how do you weigh these two things, one, life experience, the other, your genetic makeup?
Let me rephrase what you just said about...
Yes.
At this point, the perspective is that almost everything is genetic in origin. Okay. So and it's pretty indisputable now. There are too many twin studies that have demonstrated that everything you say about yourself, or even what other people see in you, has some type of genetic origin. I mean, even as far as supposedly random life events, such as foreclosing on your house, getting a divorce, having accidents, these even have genetic components. And it gets almost ridiculous to the point that anything you throw at a twin study, and which is typically used to determine whether something has a genetic origin, you find some genetic component to it. And in the field of personality, every single trait category has 20 to 50% of a genetic component. And that's the important point. It's 20 to 50%, leaving 50% to the environment, so to speak, or other things. Okay. And so, yes, everything has a genetic component. Is that the ultimate reason for what we do? No. And also, it's not clear what it means when something is genetic. It doesn't mean that it's immutable and unchangeable. It just means that there is probably some temperamental beginning to what happens. Mm-hmm. Temperaments and genes can't act without environments, and so we have to facilitate them. And we probably do that a lot with our kids, I suspect. If you have a temperamental child, you try to keep them away from things that make them anxious. And that's probably a reasonable thing to do because you don't want to make them cry. But that might be facilitating their temperament, so to speak, as opposed to changing it. And we don't know yet what all these factors are that contribute to that type of gene by environment interaction. And those studies are just starting to come out. When it comes to how our environments affect us, there are a couple of things, very provocative findings. Back to the parents, there doesn't seem to be a lot of what they call shared family effects. So the role of parents in determining the character of their kids seems to be less strong than we suspected. And it's the unique experiences that kids have with their peers, with their parents and their family, their brothers and sisters, that is responsible for that other 50%. And they're still trying to figure out why. When it comes to the effects of our life experiences, especially on our personality traits, they do affect our development, but the effects are relatively small. So you're not going to go through a profound change by acquiring a new job or acquiring a new boyfriend or girlfriend or spouse. It's not going to make your world – it's going to make your world different. It probably won't make you as different as you might hope.
Yeah. So the bottom line to all of this is, if you ask the question, is it possible for personality to change into adulthood as we get older? Answer, yeah. Can we change if we want to? Yeah. Do we change as a result of things beyond our control? Yeah. But do we become different people?
No.
Probably not.
I mean, back to the idea of changing your personality, I always like to draw the analogy to tobacco addiction. And in the tobacco addiction literature, the average time to discontinue smoking is 10 years. And from the point of thinking about it to actually successfully stopping, it takes people an average of 10 years to stop that very simple behavior. It's a very addictive behavior. But if you think about your personality, this is something that, you know, emerges naturally out of what you do. It's probably far more addictive in some respects than something like tobacco smoke. So if you're planning on transforming either yourself or your spouse or your brother or your sister or your family members, my caution is always to set a 10-year plan at a minimum. That, you know, if you want to change them, you should take your time and not expect it to happen next week, next year when you meet for your family reunion or something like that. Or even for that matter, have a profound effect on the way they behave in one vacation or one weekend. That's not going to happen.
I'm just curious now, if within the field of personality research, has anyone tried to put together a sample of individuals who did seemingly radically change their personality? You know, maybe you couldn't do a study like that. Maybe it would be so anecdotal and so difficult to control, you wouldn't be able to say anything meaningful. Has someone tried to do that?
No. I mean, there are a couple of people who have written some case studies. We've tracked people and tracked the magnitude of the change that they've demonstrated. And what we find is for young adults is that in one out of five trait domains, each person is probably going to go through a relatively robust change over an eight-year period. So on one thing, like being anxious, you'll probably change a lot over a decent amount of time. On the rest of your personality, at least in the terms of traits, you probably won't. So each of us has the potential, I think, in any given life period, especially young adulthood, I suspect, to go through profound change, but probably on one thing within our characterological spectrum, as opposed to everything that we do. And that's not something to sneeze at. I mean, if you are anxious and you change quite dramatically on that, that could make profound changes in your life and your perspective on the world, and that could be a very important thing. If you go from being shy to being very confident in social settings and doing well in leadership positions which you didn't feel comfortable in before, that's a very important type of change. So it's not their total personality, so to speak, but one or two areas we see this happen.
So, Brent, has anybody looked at changes after people kind of go through significant events, like before and after going into the military and going to war?
There are some definitive studies on the Vietnam War and war experiences, both the Vietnam War and the Korean War. And the most surprising thing from that study was that there wasn't a large effect on global personality. There was an effect to the extent that somebody saw action. And the more dramatic and problematic that action was, you could assume would result in something like PTSD. And these people tended to look a little less healthy coming out of the experience. But as
did those people change or just get exaggerated in the areas that they were already predisposed towards?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to that in the context of the studies that I'm describing. But I do know in our research, one thing that we do find, we call it the corresponsive principle, which is the idea that each of us does differ in our personality traits. And for instance, some people tend to be very dominant and some people tend to be very submissive. The dominant people tend to go into work settings that engage leadership. So they look at a work setting as an opportunity to go up the status hierarchy, and they would like to get the reins of the business and do things that let them control other people. And to some extent, they do. So they are afforded that opportunity. Through doing those things, they actually become more dominant. So you see this accentuation or deepening of characteristics that draw you into a specific life path. Mm-hmm. And it's a nice finding to some extent because it retains the idea that our personality is unique and that in part shapes the paths that we follow. And those paths will in some respects make us more of who we are than maybe something different completely.
Mm-hmm. So how do people change? Is there any looking at how people change after they become parents?
So far we haven't found a lot, which is surprising. I always attribute it to the fact that we haven't assessed the right type of psychological characteristics. So humbleness is not a term that we usually assess or look at. And I think that's probably the most profound change when people become parents. But there are only two or three studies so far that I've seen attempt to relate things like becoming a parent to personality change, and they haven't resulted in much. What I should say is that we're relatively crude at this stage for how to assess these types of transitions. So it's often described in very demographic terms. Are you a parent? Are you not? Mm-hmm. As opposed to the experience that you're having. And the experience, as you know, is dictated in large part by the family context, the temperament of the child, your work environment, your family environment, what type of social support. Are you living in a town with your parents or not? All of these things contribute to the experience you have as a parent. And I think if we could describe or quantify that in a little more detail, we would find something. But to date, nobody's actually looked at it in that depth.
We got about 15 minutes left here in the program. I have a couple of callers, and I want to bring them in a conversation. And I guess I better introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in. I'd like to know who it is we're talking with. Brent Roberts is Associate Professor of Psychology at University of Illinois here at Urbana-Champaign. He's interested particularly in personality. He's the Associate Editor of the Journal of Research in Personality. And in his research, he's done a lot of work looking at how it is that personality either changes or stays relatively stable across adulthood and why it is that happens. And Ashley Beidle is a licensed clinical psychologist in private practice in Champaign. He does medium and long-term therapy with both adults and adolescents. And questions are welcome here. We've been talking about personality and some of the research that looks at whether or not personality changes, particularly once a person becomes an adult. As we said at the beginning of the program, generally people believe that once you get to be an adult, your personality is pretty well set. And there are a lot of psychologists would say, yes, that's true. There is, however, other kinds of research that shows people can and do change as they get older. They may not become completely different people. But also, we're not saying that it's absolutely, personality is absolutely fixed and nothing happens once you get past 30. We have a couple callers here, and we'll go next to Charleston on our line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I had two things. One is a book I'd recommend for the previous caller who is interested in the use of medication to treat depression or whatever. The book is called Healing Through the Dark Emotions. It's by Miriam Greenspan, and she is basically arguing that we can learn from grief, despair, and fear, and that, in fact, we can use that experience to develop and grow and become a different person, which you kind of short-circuit if you're using medication. She's not anti-meds, but she's it was a wonderful book, really helped me out a good deal. But to talk about the experience of grief as a learning experience that the person can grow from. And again, it's Miriam Greenspan, called Healing Through the Dark Emotions. And so I just want to mention that. And my question for you is, I'm wondering where you are, where the discipline is in terms of, I remember Walter Mischel's, 1970 study, meta-analysis, where he was able to demonstrate that the amount of variance accounted for by personality was extremely small, I think 0.30. I was wondering where the discipline is in handling, do we really have a personality? Does a person's behavior, is it consistent, or do we rather tend to see more consistency in people's behavior than, in fact, actually exists?
Well, that's an interesting question.
I know. It's a well-trained person. You must have been a psychology major at a good institution.
0.30 results get people tenure these days.
They do. I've got a couple. I could speak for the rest of the hour on that topic. A couple of interesting things have happened. I mean, the first thing we found out was that the argument that personality or any other psychological variable has a small effect is incorrect in the sense that the scale that Michel was using was wrong originally. And that is to say that almost every effect in psychology has the effect that Michel identified. So whether it's a social psychologist doing an experiment, a neuropsychologist doing an fMRI study, actually they have bigger effects, but the interesting thing that we've discovered in the interim is that effect sizes are small in psychology, in the sense that they're not accounting for everything that happens within a person's life. And to some extent, that's appropriate because any one disposition shouldn't affect everything that happens to a person. And so the modest effects that we find sufficient for tenure are also what are ubiquitous within the scientific field. So that finding is not a problem anymore from that perspective. When it comes to things like how consistent we are, on the other hand, the effect sizes are actually much larger. So the smallest effect size you find for people being consistent over time is in 3-year-olds, where it is 0.3. When you get to 50-year-olds, the consistency over a 7-year period is 0.75.
Oh, wow.
And that's in how people see themselves and in how other people see them. So when you're talking about particular types of effects, you start seeing larger effect sizes, but with a huge caveat that in any general sense in psychology, if you're going to do an investigation or look at the effect of some intervention or some type of variable predicting something, the effect size is typically small. And that's just true for psychology. It's true in some respects, I suspect, for lots of sciences.
Okay, then I recall the whole debate between person versus situation.
Mm-hmm. And well, to make the point, the situations which are often invoked have the same effect size as personality traits. So there were subsequent studies done where they transformed the statistics that were used to characterize the classic social psychological experiments, and they have the same effect sizes between 0.3 and 0.4.
So does that mean then that less is accounted for by both person and situation? I mean, so there's still a large amount of behavior that is unaccounted for?
Well, it's biased a bit by the way we do our research, which we tend to be very focused on what we do. So we're not usually assessing a large spectrum of factors. When you look at studies that do, there's a Project A in the Army, which was done by IO psychologists, where they did everything they could to predict something like success in the Marine Corps. They get effect sizes that are much larger, upwards of 0.5 to 0.6, by combining lots of different things. So a measure of cognitive ability, personality traits, judgments by supervisors, all of these things combined, you can get much more predictive validity. But that's seldom the goal of any given scientific investigation. Typically, we're interested in whether something's there and if it's reliable and if it's sufficient to get tenure. No, just kidding.
Thank you.
Thanks. Well, just for the layperson now, here, what I hear from this discussion, the question is, or I guess as I would ask the question is personality real? And can we come up with a set of characteristics that we can all agree upon that are very clear, so we can say we know what we're talking about. And we can say that, yes, in fact, people really are different from one another and that they behave, generally speaking, in ways consistent with their personality, and that to the point where we should be able, with some level of confidence, to be able to predict how person A, B, and C, with personalities A, B, and C, are going to react in certain circumstances. We can say pretty much the answer to all the questions is, yeah, we do think personality is real, that people are different. They do act in ways consistent with their personality, almost to the point where we should be able to predict how they're going to react to a particular situation based on what it is we know about their personality.
Yeah, and there's always the old adage that it's real if it has real consequences. Mm-hmm. If you look at the studies that have, for instance, taken somebody's personality, what they say about themselves in young adulthood, and predict something in late adulthood. And you find very interesting and sometimes provocative results. So one of the more infamous studies in the last decade was Howard Friedman's, showing that childhood ratings of conscientiousness predicted longevity. Not only did they predict longevity, but they predicted longevity at the same magnitude as cardiovascular reactivity, which is the major cause of death and dying in our country at the moment. That to me was like, oh, okay, this is good evidence that the effects of our personality are relatively.
So people who, as kids, would have said that they were disciplined people.
It was their parents.
Oh, their parents would have said, "My child is a disciplined person. Yeah. That person will live longer."
Yes. This is only one study. It hasn't been replicated, though. We have other effects. For instance, there's the Nun study, which shows that people who are more happy write stories about themselves in young adulthood that have more positive emotion in the stories. They lived longer also. And these are interesting studies. They're prospective. You get the assessment of personality when they're young, and you look at things when they're older. We know, for instance, that personality traits predict things like divorce. So individuals who are more impulsive and a little more anxious tend not to have as long a relationship as others. Success in the labor market can also be predicted by these things too. So the consequences for a lot of these differences between us, measured often in how people describe themselves, do have profound effects on the life course and on things like health and well-being.
Well, so if I tell my son if he cleans his room, he'll live longer.
If that helps you, yes.
Now, whether he will believe you or not,
if he's listening,
he doesn't,
you're in
trouble. Kill
him. That's the thing. Well, psychologists who are interested in personality, they obviously, you've got to have some way to quantify it, and apparently that there are five big standard categories that people talk about, and we've talked about one of them. It's conscientiousness, which basically, I guess, means is how disciplined a person are you. And there's also things like, you know, how well do you get along with other people? Are you shy or are you outgoing? You know, those kinds of things. If you ask the question, okay, based on the kind of studies that have been done about how personality does change, are there particular qualities that tend to be more malleable where one is more likely to change So are there some things that seem to change in respects people change a lot, or other respects in which, looking at some of the basic characteristics, you'd say, on this scale, no, people aren't going to change very much? Or is that, or can you not make a generalization like that?
Well, it's an interesting question. I don't know if we have enough data yet to make the determination. I know there are certain trait categories that change more than others. So there's a facet of extroversion that we call social dominance. So it's the confidence you have in being in a group setting and mm-hmm. being willing to speak up when there's a group of people around and to make a decision about what the group should do. There you see a profound amount of change, especially in young adulthood, where people become much more confident in themselves. You don't see as much change in the kind of emotional core of extroversion, which we think of as positive emotion, the sociability, the talkativeness and gregariousness. That doesn't seem to change as much as certain other aspects of personality. And in fact, it seems to decrease a little bit in old age.
So would extroversion, for instance, change with competence and getting older and feeling more capable in more areas of their lives?
I think that's where the social dominance aspect is coming from. So the reason why people become more confident in themselves in those settings is because you get more experiences doing it. You realize that it is, you know, not something to be as nervous about, and therefore you see yourself as a much more socially competent individual in that setting. It doesn't necessarily make you more talkative. You're not going to spark up a conversation because of that. But if somebody calls upon you to actually lead your group at work to do something, you're going to be less anxious about that when you're 30 or 40 than you were when you were 20. Mm-hmm. And that's where you see.
And just because if provided you did it one time and it was okay, and you did it the next time and you thought, oh, well, that was okay, that wasn't so bad. The more times you do that and the more times it's okay, then the less you'll think that it's a problem, and the easier it will be, the less worried you'll be, the more confident you'll be. It just has it's the accumulation of positive experience that says, okay, this is no big deal.
Yeah. Presumably.
Well, sometimes what I see is people who are really struggle in that regard have very narrow areas of expertise, and within those areas then they can kind of get out and mm-hmm. and be a little more out in the world,
yeah.
like being a outstanding musician or something.
We have a couple of callers. We'll see if we can get them in. Certainly we'll try and get one. We'll go to somebody here on cell phone, line two. Hello.
Hi. I mm-hmm. just wanted to raise a cautionary note. I'm recently retired, and I have a twin sister, and she keeps telling me how important it is for me to be sociable and to maintain a social life based upon what she's read in the newspapers. And the question that I ask her is, do those studies indicate that if you were unsociable when you were young, that you should become sociable when you're old? Because I've never actually liked people very much, and I can't see how I can make myself like them. I said, or are you really talking about people who were sociable and who follow the tendency of older people who basically lose their friends due to moving away and death, et cetera? And some of these prescriptions don't really seem to account for what you were before you reach a middle age. And also the question is, does making the change when you're older have an effect as opposed to just keeping the personality you always had? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, really interesting questions. And I guess now having sat here and had the conversation, my feeling would be this: if you didn't like people when you were younger, you're not going to like them any better when you're older. That's really not going to change.
But David, irascible, strong-minded people tend to live longer.
Okay, well, we're back on the longevity.
People are pain in the butt in the nursing home live longer.
That's a stereotype.
Back on the longevity thing.
No, well, if I can support his sister, I would say that what she's alluding to is probably the social support literature, which says that if you have a circle of friends and acquaintances who would be there for you when you suffer from a fall or from a problem, you're much more likely to survive. And that might not require that you like them. You could, if I'm going to try to provide a prescription for somebody to adapt to the fact that they're not sociable, but yet at the same time, if you can create a social support network for yourself in old age, we know that contributes to living longer, if that's your goal.
And it doesn't have to be a large group. One good friend, one person that you're...
And introverted people who are not sociable typically have fewer friends but very good ones. And so if you have these friends in your social circle, then you have much... you have a higher probability of survival.
Mm-hmm. I think we're close to the point where we're going to have to finish up. And I think maybe I'd better not take the last caller on hold. My apologies, but I'm afraid we're going to end up going too far. I guess I feel like it's one of those issues where you ask the question, does personality change or not? And unfortunately, the answer comes back, well, it depends, or yes and no, or something about that.
Well, I think the answer is yes. I think it's more clear than that in that respect, yeah. And the changes are relatively positive. It's just a question. I think the qualifier is how much. And that's where I think you need to step back and not support the stereotype that people can transform themselves.
Okay. Well, I thank you both very much for
thank
being
you.
Here. Good to,
thanks.
Good to talk with you. Our guest, Brent Roberts, he is a professor of psychology, associate professor of psychology here at the University of Illinois, interested in personality research, and also Ashley Beidle. He's a licensed clinical psychologist with private practice here in Champaign. And again, I appreciate it.